Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. While globalization has lifted millions from poverty, the forces that drove it have largely left the middle class behind. There's a growing sense that the social contract is broken. This week is the second in our three-part series on rebuilding the social contract. We take three different perspectives, that of the people, that of the business world, and that of government. This second episode is focused on the role of the business sector, its shareholders versus its stakeholders. Since deregulation in the 1980s, the shareholder appeared to reign supreme, but something else has happened. The business sector has increasingly seen its role as advancing the social good. Joining us is J. Cohn Gilbert. He co-founded B Lab, and Colin Mayer, professor at Oxford University and author of the book Prosperity: Better Business Makes the Greater Good. Moderating the program is my co-host Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
Colin Mayer, welcome to the program. What motivates people to be participants in a capitalist economy? What makes them get up every day and put their shoes on and head out the door?
Two things. First of all, they want to earn a reasonable income for themselves, for their families. And secondly, they want to feel motivated that they're going to be doing something that's worthwhile, that they feel fulfilling. And those two components are critical to getting people to really participate in their employment.
What about the rules of the game? Do they have to be fair? Do they have to be perceived as fair in order to continue to get the willing, voluntary participation of people?
Absolutely. The rules of the game by which companies behave are critically important in terms of ensuring that they do what people expect and want of them, and that they feel that they treat people fairly and recognize the fact that they are seeking to undertake fulfilling and meaningful work, and that there's a fair distribution of what is generated in a company between the different parties to the firm.
Now, if you look at the history of, Anglo-American capitalism, let's say, over the last 40 years, people have been told over and over again, with vehemence, with insistence, with persistence, that government doesn't matter, that only business can fix some of the problems facing society, that government is impotent and ineffective, and that, in fact, it's the very disinterest of capitalism that is their buddy, their friend, their ally. Is the bloom off the rose? Are large numbers of people bailing out on that idea?
Yeah, there's a real change in perception as to what business should be doing, what government should be doing, and what the two should be doing together. The notion that the business of business is just business in terms of seeking to generate returns for shareholders is a recent phenomenon. It's basically a post-1960s phenomenon. It wasn't the focus of the purpose of business over nearly all of its 2,000-year history. And that belief that business should be solely focused on profit emanated out of a view that there needed to be a separation between government and business. But we're increasingly realizing that the role that business plays in terms of delivering our needs as societies and individuals has increased substantially over the last 60-year period, and that separation between the role of government and business is much less straightforward than has been thought to be the case.
Well, one of the intellectual godfathers of this latest iteration, you might say, is Milton Friedman, who said, no, we don't want corporations that do for people. They make a very simple compact with their workers, with their customers, and with their shareholders And as long as everybody understands what their highest and best role is, we're all going to be happier as a result. Is he wrong?
Yes. The idea, as he described it, that there is one and only one social purpose of business, to increase profits so long as it stays within the rules of the game, was a misconceived notion. It emanated out of the view that there had been too much interference with business and too much attempt by business to undertake what he regarded as being solely the legitimate activity of government. But that view that there is only one purpose of business, to make money, has been increasingly a source of growing inequality, environmental degradation, and mistrust in business.
So what does a good corporation keep in mind? What does it look like? What does, when we use that term even, what are we talking about?
We're talking about a corporation with a real sense of purpose. Purpose is the reason that something exists, why it's created, what it does, and what it aspires to become. And that's more than just making money. Indeed, the purpose of business is not to produce profits. The purpose of business is to produce profitable solutions to the problems of people and planet. And in the process, it produces profits, but profits are not per se the purpose of business.
Well, that would be a radical proposition to people of a certain age who've grown up with these assumptions. Let's say in a world where Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were very influential preachers of the gospel of a corporation that just had fiduciary responsibilities, that had no wider responsibilities than that.
That's correct. The implication of the Friedman Doctrine, as it's termed, has been to essentially establish that principle as being the basis of business practice, business policy, and business education around the world. And because it's at the heart of the way in which we teach the next generation of business leaders, it's been perpetuated as the notion that that is the only way in which we can conceive of business. But it's not the way in which business was originally conceived. It hasn't been the feature of business for nearly all of its 2,000-year existence. And it's increasingly recognized to be a source of failure of business going forward in terms of its contribution to us as societies, as individuals, to the environment, and to the success of business.
Well, for readers of your new book, Prosperity, it's that very idea that it hasn't always been so that I think will rock their world more than anything else, because it's kind of the received wisdom of modern Western life, that it has always been so, that this is why people come together and form corporations in the first place. But you point out, not only going back to Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations, but going back to the earliest days of the corporation, that there was not only perceived to be a wider set of responsibilities, but understood by all the participants to be a wider set of responsibilities. Tell us more.
That's exactly right. It was established to undertake a public purpose. It was created under Roman law 2,000 years ago as what is termed the Societas Publicanorum. And what that corporation did was to perform vital public functions, collecting taxes, minting coins, building infrastructure, looking after buildings, etc. And thereafter, it was the basis of numerous forms of institutions, including many universities around the world, including the university in which I sit here in Oxford, it was established as a corporation. And thereafter, it developed along the lines of merging with notions of partnership by which capital was raised on very large scale. And from about the 15th century onwards, it took off as a major contributory factor to the promotion of growth and prosperity around the world. It's been the source of the alleviation of poverty, of the generation of income. And through that period, it recognized that it was combining a commercial function with this more broad public social role. And it's only since this notion that Milton Friedman put forward, that the idea of the corporation as being a sole generator of profits has arisen.
But didn't he think also that some of these other challenges would be taken care of by other institutions and other stakeholders? That if you had a corporation acting in this strictly self-interested manner, that the negative externalities, let's say, the other bad things that happen as a result, would be handled elsewhere, and that corporations would be restrained from bad behavior from other people who are exerting their own force and influence in the marketplace.
That's correct. So underpinning the Friedman notion is, first of all, the importance of competition. Competition in product markets, in labor markets, in financial markets. And where competition and markets don't work, the effectiveness of regulation in laying down the rules of the game. Now, the problem with that is that there are many areas where there's a major void between that market efficiency and regulatory effectiveness, where markets fail and regulation fails. And in that void, we depend on the trustworthiness of companies to uphold our interests and to convert our self-interest into a broader common good. Now, to rely on charitable organizations and government to provide public services and philanthropic activities is to fail to recognize the fact that where there are failures of competition and regulation, then there are serious consequences for society, for the environment, and for us as individuals, as employees and consumers. And that's where the importance of recognizing that business has a role beyond just reflecting the interests of its shareholders comes into play. And it's in that void that the notion that business is solely concerned with profits has had its most damaging effects.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because I'm wondering where the flaw in the system is. If we take this Friedmanite world of unrestrained self-interest being hemmed in, being cooled off by other forces in the society, when these relationships get out of whack, they're self-correcting because bad businesses get punished, their shareholders lose value, they lose profitability, they go out of business, in fact, while other more, let's say, valorous actors are rewarded by those same set of relationships. Where's the flaw in that? Why have we gotten to a point early in the 21st century where there's wholesale disenchantment with that?
Let me just explain what underpinned the Friedman Doctrine and what's changed since then. Underpinning the Friedman Doctrine is a property right view of the firm, that the owners, the shareholders, own the firm in the way in which you and I own cars and houses. And because they've invested in their companies, they have a property right, just like you and I have property rights over our cars and homes. And there was some justification for that during a period in which, in essence, companies comprised buildings, plant, machinery, physical assets that the owners had to invest in. But three things have happened since then. The first is that companies are increasingly not about tangible assets, as their term, plant, building, machinery. They are increasingly about intangible assets, in particular, human capital, rather than physical capital. And increasingly, companies are becoming global in nature, not just in being multinational, but also in terms of having global products and services. Think Google, think Facebook. Those are companies that thrive on having a global, not just a national market for their products. So the social impact of companies has increased just as the ownership rights of individuals have diminished because the extent to which they're dependent on the investment by owners has diminished. And finally, the impact that companies are having on their environment has dramatically increased as environmental concerns have intensified. So we're seeing a world that has changed from the view that property rights are justified to exactly the opposite, that it's the obligations and responsibilities of companies to take account of the impact of their activities on the societies and environments in which they operate.
Sometimes these values work at cross purposes. I've covered a lot of industrial communities around the world, and when they see smoke coming out of the stacks, they see that as a good thing because it's money, and it means that they'll be able to feed their families. And if you say, look, what if they have to spend some money to make sure that the place can continue to operate, but less is going to come out of those stacks? That sounds very risky. It sounds very perilous. They're afraid of downward pressure on wages. They're afraid of downward pressure on employment. The idea that you have to accept a certain amount of degradation in return for a certain amount of return as a worker is deeply baked into a lot of communities around the world.
And that's exactly the attitude that needs to change. And we need to have a recognition that that is not the only way of doing business, and it's not even necessarily the most profitable way of doing business. Come back to what I described as being the purpose of business, to produce profitable solutions to the problems of people and planet. That is not philanthropy. It's not charity. It's about hard-nosed business. And what it does is to recognize the opportunities that exist in terms of thinking of solving the problems of you and me and the rest of our communities and our natural capital and environment. That by addressing those problems, we are encouraging a form of business innovation, not dissimilar to the technological innovations that are having a dramatic impact on our lives. And that by recognizing the potential for those business innovations, not only can business really make a fundamental contribution to improving our lives, but in the process, just as with technological innovations, they have the potential for yielding significant returns because of the novel ways in which they are undertaking their businesses.
You note in your book that Adam Smith was careful to balance the importance that he attached to markets with morality in the theory of moral sentiments and in The Wealth of Nations itself. He talks about understanding what the externalities are, not letting the balance between needs and demands get too out of whack. If you went into a boardroom today and talked about kindness, I think that people would look at you like you had two heads.
And that notion of the importance of morality in business that Adam Smith noted was not simply a statement of it being ethically desirable, but a recognition that it was associated with good business and well-conducted business. And when people argue that those elements of ethical conduct are contrary to well-functioning business, they fail to recognize the fact that what Adam Smith was noting, namely that they are a source of good business practice. That in essence, what really makes us feel that we are doing worthwhile activities as employees is to feel pride from contributing to the success, the common success of the business in helping others. We derive real pride from achievements of that sort, and we feel shame when we let people down in terms of those accomplishments and helping to create that common purpose. And those notions of pride and shame were precisely the types of moral sentiments that Adam Smith was noting as being core, not just to our daily lives, but also to the ways in which we operate in a commercial setting. At least they should be. But far from business intensifying those feelings and senses of reciprocity, assisting others, and contributing to a common purpose, the implication of the Friedman Doctrine has been to move business in exactly the opposite direction.
How do we get back that notion that corporations have a wider set of responsibilities than strictly a fiduciary one?
There are three key elements to this. The first is a recognition by companies themselves that they have a wider responsibility beyond just looking after their shareholders, that they have a responsibility to us as employees, to us as societies, and to the environment around us. And many companies are increasingly recognizing that to be the case. And the notion of purpose beyond profit is gaining increasing acceptance in business around the world. But in many cases, business feels hamstrung by the attitude of their investors, and in particular their institutional investors, which seem to be focused on only one issue, and that is their financial returns and their delivery of maximum value for their shareholders. And what is required in addition to a change in attitude of companies to do this is a change in attitude on the part of institutional investors to a recognition that by becoming more engaged long-term investors, not only are they helping companies to promote their purposes and supporting them in the achievement of that, but also that yields higher returns over the long term for their investors as well. So it creates shareholder value over the long term. But what is going to be required in addition to those changing attitudes on the part of companies and investors is a recognition that our laws and regulation are not well suited to promote this type of activity on the part of companies. The law still places primary emphasis, in particular in the UK and the United States, on shareholder interests. And it does not encourage companies to put a wider purpose at the center of their activities.
So what you're suggesting, it sounds like, would require corporate leaders to be a vanguard class, are willing to stick their necks out, are willing to take a risk of saying to all their stakeholders, we want to count other things besides just what's counted in the conventional ledger books as part of understanding what our responsibility is. Is that fair?
That's absolutely correct. A recognition that there is more that should be counted than purely financial profit. And so a key element in terms of linking these parties together, namely companies and investors, is to have a system of accounting and reporting that reflects the impact that companies have not just on their shareholders and their financial performance, but also on their wider contribution in terms of social capital, human capital, and natural capital. And a lot of work is going into providing precisely those types of measures of performance beyond just financial capital.
Professor Colin Mayer joined us from Oxford. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
We've been hearing from Colin Mayer of Oxford University. After the break, we'll hear from Jay Cohn Gilbert, co-founder of B-Lab. The topic is the role of the private sector in rebuilding the social contract. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Jay Cohn Gilbert. He's co-founder of B-Lab, and Colin Mayer, a professor at Oxford University. He's the author of the book Prosperity: Better Business Makes the Greater Good. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program again or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Jay Cohn Gilbert, you've said we are at the early stages of a capitalist reformation. And I want to know why you believe that, because right now, people's confidence in corporations remains pretty high, even after the global recession and the behavior of some of the players. And trust in government is pretty low, lower, in fact, than that of private business. What's pushing a capitalist reformation if people still have confidence that businesses are going to help us work our way out of our current funk?
Well, Ray, thanks for having me. I guess I would begin by questioning a core assumption that you stated, which is that people have faith and trust in business, particularly big business. The data that I've seen and that's shared pretty widely within the business community and that most CEOs that we speak with are pretty aware of and keep top of mind is that public trust in business, particularly bigger business, and particularly business that's engaged with the capital markets, is actually at an all-time low. And not only in business and the capital markets, but the underlying economic system, the capitalist system, is actually never been more distrusted as having the best interests of workers and communities and the natural world sort of at its core. And so when I think of why I think we're at the early stages of a capitalist reformation, one is because I think people are demanding it. And we see that in consumer behavior, investor behavior, worker behavior, but also because it's necessary. If you look at the eroding systems as it pertains to inequality or climate or soil or water, et cetera, people are very aware that the economic system as it's functioning today isn't really working for the majority of people, not just in the U.S. but around the world. And as a result, you see these social movements from yellow vests in Paris to Bolsonaro in Brazil to what we see on both the left and the right here in the U.S., all sort of reacting to an economy that doesn't work for everyone. And so what we need is a reformation of the capitalist system so indeed it's designed to work for everyone.
Now, granted, that number of higher trust in private business than in government is in part driven by the fact that the trust in government has gone so low, granted. But throughout our history in the United States, we've had pendulum swings where when things get too out of whack, people look to government as an answer, as an antidote, as a break on the unbridled, uncontrolled activity of private business. You saw it in the late 19th century. You saw it in the early 20th with the progressive movement. But recently, after the backs of global capitalists were nearly broken and they ran to governments around the world to save their chestnuts and put out their fires, what did we do in the United States? We elected a government that promised to end the Consumer Protection Bureau, that promised to take off the regulations on banking and business that had been put on in the aftermath of the Great Recession. We elected a government that said, oh, no, 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 you can't trust government to do any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so let those animal spirits that Adam Smith talked about get on with the business of making us all rich.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I think everything you said is true. And at the same time, in that decade, we had laws passed in 35 states, as well as in a few different countries adopted by the G7, to create a distinct new type of corporation called the Benefit Corporation that operates by a different set of rules. And in the U.S., in those 34, 35 states, there were 17 Republican governors, including current Vice President Mike Pence, and 17 Democratic governors who signed the same legislation into law, which created a more hospitable environment for business leaders and investors to create, invest in, and build businesses that have purpose at their center and use profit as a fuel for that purpose, but don't have profit at the center, relegating every other consideration to the margins or the fringes. And so at the same time that we had sort of populist uprisings, if you will, here and abroad, and some sort of deregulatory energy, to your point, at the same time, we had sort of interesting public-private partnership where you had these private sector innovations of business leaders that were purpose-driven, working with policymakers to create a new legal entity that would give them both the legal permission and the legal protection to run their businesses in a new way. And I know one of the things you're interested in is can the private sector sort of reorient business culture and help rebuild the social contract? And if we're going to rebuild the social contract between business and society, we literally have to look at the contract. We have to look at the law that governs corporate behavior. And so the law of these new types of corporations, these B corporations, is actually distinct from the law that governs the rest of corporations. And this new law says that the core purpose of the business is to create a material positive impact for society and the environment, to care about people, and customers and suppliers and communities and the natural world on which all life depends. That's their legal obligation. And so it's no longer do that when you have an enlightened CEO, or do that when the business climate is good, or do that in an up, you know, bull market. That's now a legal requirement. That means that that's at the core of the business, and that legal requirement engenders more trust, because people know that you don't just care about them when it's good for you. You care about them in all circumstances, and that's now a part of how they have to make decisions in the boardroom 24/7.
It's likely you who are listening to this program have heard of the corporations that are B corporations, benefit corporations, but you may not know it just from being a customer. They include Cabot Creamery, Ben & Jerry's, Clean Canteen, the drinking bottle maker, Stonyfield Organic, the yogurt and dairy product company, New Belgium Brewery, which creates Fat Tire and other beers, and Amalgamated Bank, which began as a union-owned bank. So you might say that a wider idea of stakeholders was part of their DNA from the very beginning. Amalgamated Bank is a pretty old institution. Not on this list is, you know, General Motors and Dow Chemical and IBM and or Apple, for that matter. Mm-hmm. What do these corporations share in their history, in their mission, in their idea about what a company should do that links them together, that made them the kind of places that would become B corporations?
B Corp span, you know, over 150 different industries in 60 or 70 countries around the world. So it's a fairly diverse movement. And what unites them all is a common vision to redefine success in business, and a common belief that business should compete to be best for the world, not just best in the world. And so best for their workers, best for their communities, best for the environment. And in addition to that common vision, what really inspires me is that these entrepreneurs are not just sort of talking a good game. And using the latest sort of trendy buzzword, marketing buzzwords around responsibility or sustainability or impact. But they're actually willing to hold themselves accountable, not only to that legal standard that we talked about prior, that gives it all some teeth, but also to higher standards of transparency. So ultimately the public, whether those are investors or potential workers or consumers, can look for themselves and sort of kick the tires for themselves as to whether the company is actually walking its talk. And then perhaps most importantly, all of those companies, those nearly 3,000 certified B corporations around the world, all have allowed themselves to be subject to independent third-party verified standards of performance around their worker practices, their supply chain practices, their community engagement, their environmental practices. And so those companies go through the most rigorous assessment along with third-party verification that they're actually walking their talk. And that's part of what helps build trust between those companies and the people that work for them, those companies and the people that want to invest in them and make sure their money is not only making more money, to your point, but also making a difference. And also to the consumers, you know, who want to make purchases with a higher purpose than just cost and convenience and deliciousness. Like, you get all those things, but you also want to make sure that the company you're investing in is actually doing right by their workers and paying a living wage, or doing right by the environment so your kids can go for a swim in the river.
Not that long ago, a vice president of the United States called conservation a private virtue, something that you do for yourself and for your own reasons, but not one that could be required of others. Is this always going to be a small out section of American capitalism? Or are there people who both buy the products and buy shares and make inward investment who are going to say, no, I'm making an affirmative choice. The reason I'm buying this consumer product, the reason I'm buying this share instead of this one, is that I'm using my dollar like a vote. I'm actually changing my behavior in order to encourage what I see as viable, not only viable, but also to be encouraged ideas about how we should run things.
Yeah, Ray, I think you're spot on. I think the notion of voting and citizenship and sort of where the power lies in this is spot on. And I think that increasingly we're seeing people vote every day. and recognize that they've got a power to vote every day and a power beyond the ballot box. And the cash register is a ballot box. Like, they've got a bunch of votes in their wallet. And whether they're voting with their purchases or, to your point, voting with their investment dollars, or I'd argue, and most CEOs believe, like, the most important vote that people are making is where they choose to work. Mm-hmm. And so your most powerful way you engage in the economy is actually where you choose to bring your talent every day. And the CEOs that we talk with, from smaller companies like some of the ones you've mentioned to large Fortune 500, publicly traded multinationals, the number one thing that unites all those CEOs is recognizing that they're competing for talent each and every day, and that their most important assets walk out of the office every evening, and they have to make sure they come back and are not only coming back, but they're highly motivated and engaged and productive. And the way that they are deciding to compete on that in the 21st century, the imperative for 21st century business leadership is that you compete on purpose. And so I think that's the big trend that's going on that has a lot of CEOs having a little bit of FOMO, right? A fear of missing out on the next big business trend, which is competing on purpose and doing so in an authentic and credible way.
In my years as a reporter, I've ended up going to the World Economic Forum in Davos many years, to the Aspen Ideas Festival, to the Skoll World Forum in Oxford, to the climate conferences, the COPs run around the world at various times. And at the heart of these conversations, the great and the good from around the world, they converge on a place. And one of the most potent selling points for this idea, set of ideas that you're talking about, is that it pays off as well as does good things. Yeah. It's got to work in order to be an effective argument in their world. It's got to work both on the bottom line and on workers who show up to work, workers who are as productive or more productive. It has to not cost you anything, right, even though it may have ancillaries that are fabulous, right, that mean that the streams near your factory are not polluted or filled with hot water, that mean the skies are cleaner, that mean the people who live around your where you do your business are better off and healthier. But the way we do accounting, mm-hmm, the way we count what counts, doesn't count those things. And I'm wondering whether we can ever go to scale on this stuff, right, if we still live in a world where standard accounting counts the things that it counts, yeah, rather than the things that you've been talking about for all this time.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And that's one of the reasons why when you study behavior change, it is never lasting unless the external environment and the incentives shift. Otherwise, you're just sort of asking people to quit smoking or lose weight or go to the gym or whatever it is. And if you haven't changed their external environment or the underlying incentives, almost all behavior change lapses within a 12 or 18 month period back down to the almost to like a 5% shift level. And so the powerful thing about B Corps is that legal shift, right? Because the legal change is a change in the operating environment of the company, right? No longer is the company legally obligated to maximize shareholder value, right? So that's a big shift in incentives in the operating environment in that boardroom. And so the question is, sure, it's terrific that there's now these 3,000 companies that have voluntarily adopted that new incentive structure, that new legal operating environment. But Jay, there's over 100 million companies in the world. It's still pretty, pretty marginal. And I think that's a fair criticism, and so it's one of the reasons why some folks are very excited, not just about those 35 governors, equally Republican or Democratic, that have created the opportunity for companies to opt into it, but why folks are some folks are pretty excited about proposals like Senator Warren's Accountable Capitalism Act, where what she has said is that the pace of adoption of this new social contract between business and society is not fast enough, either to address the problems that we've got or to address the inequities that need to be addressed. And so her proposal is that all companies, what she would call large companies, over $1 billion, which only really, only affects about 3,800 companies in the United States. So like of the 100 million, there are only 3,800 that are over $1 billion. So she's not talking about regulating. For starters, she's not talking about regulating every company. What she is saying is that for those companies that have that are too big to fail, if you will, it's not just they're too big to fail their shareholders. They're too big to fail society, right? The impact of their business on their workforces, on their local communities, on the environment is too big. We can't have them fail us. And so once you get to that size, and many of those companies are publicly traded, you should be required to adopt this new legal structure where you're still not prescribing that they do X or they do Y or they do Z. What you've changed is the nature of the conversation in the boardroom, where the nature of the conversation in the boardroom for those companies is now our legal obligation is to care for our workers and to care for our communities and to care for our customers and do that profitably. But the nature of the conversation is how do we balance all those interests, not how do we maximize the benefit for one of those interests. And so that's one thing around where there's a robust public policy debate that's going to take place over the next 24 months or 18 months in this presidential cycle here in the U.S., where there's going to be a robust debate on what the role of business in society is and what is the appropriate social contract between our business community and the rest of our community and who is serving whom. And that's not a B Corp debate. B Corp is providing an example of an alternative way for us to do business that creates a balance of interests and puts purpose at the center, puts community at the center, and puts people at the center of an economy. And we're going to have an opportunity to debate that as a country. The other underlying question there, Ray, is about the business case. And for sure, in mainstream capital markets, something's got to have to drive an ROI, a positive ROI for it to have...
Return on investment for people who don't read balance sheets.
Thank you. For this to get adopted and have sort of wind at its back and for this to be... And so what's interesting is you've got things... You've had over $2 billion invested in B Corps over the last 24 months alone. So there's a lot of capital that is seeing these as... seeing it as a false choice that you can either be a purpose-driven company
or you can make money.
Yeah. I think people are increasingly looking at that as a false choice and sort of an unhelpful framing, because there's plenty, all those B Corps that you mentioned, the Patagonias, the New Belgiums, the Stonyfields, they're making plenty of money. You know, and they're receiving plenty of outside investment, billions of dollars of outside investment.
But that's never been the argument in recent capitalist history. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been, are you making money? It's, can you make more money?
More money.
So instead of returning 32 cents on a dollar, can we squeeze all the component parts of what we're doing and make 35 cents
you
on
got
a dollar
it.
Instead?
You got it. And so I think that's a beautiful articulation of the central challenge that the B Corp model poses to traditional 20th century capitalism is the objective more, or is the objective enough? And if the objective is more, our community would sort of share, we think we're headed for some really difficult times, socially, environmentally, et cetera. Like, we're headed off a cliff on both fronts. Just a question of which one's going to hit first. Because the inexorable, insatiable demand for more is going to leave a lot of people out. And when a lot of people get out, you get yellow vests in the streets and you get all kinds of things that are happening. If the question is about enough, if we talk about a living wage, if we talk about a living return, if we talk about people that provide risk capital are providing a hugely valuable thing into the economy, we want to acknowledge that that's a really powerful thing, but that risk capital should be rewarded sufficiently, not rewarded at the expense of everything else, like a cancer that only eats everything in its way. And so I think one of the things to watch in 2019 is going to be, what is the response of the business community to that BlackRock letter to CEOs? You know, the annual letter that Larry Fink writes to, which BlackRock is the largest asset manager on the planet. They're the largest investor on the planet. They control like almost $6.5 trillion worth of assets. And every year their CEO writes a letter to CEOs saying, here's what I'm thinking and here's what I need you to do. And increasingly over the last couple of years, he's talked about a sense of purpose and profit. And so he's been banging a drum pretty loudly, pointing a finger at CEOs and saying, we need your leadership. And I think one of the interesting things is going to be, and that's certainly welcome from the largest investor on the planet, carries a lot of weight in boardrooms, and so people are paying attention. One of the interesting things is going to be what the CEO's response is going to be. Because one response is, we gotcha, and we're moving in that direction, like some of the folks that I mentioned that are moving in that direction. Another response is going to be, you know what, Larry, BlackRock, and others like them? We need your help. This isn't about corporate leadership. This is about corporate and capital markets leadership. Because when we seek to change our governance structures to align to achieve the objectives that you're asking for, long-termism creating of stakeholder value, you're asking for those things, but the actual legal structure that we've got actually incentivizes us to do the opposite. And so where the rubber will hit the road is when those CEOs come back in their own letter and say, sort of, you know, we see you and we raise you, which is we're willing to do our part, but to do our part over the long term and in a lasting and meaningful way, we need your help because we need you to vote. Because we can't change our legal structure without shareholder approval. And oh, by the way, you're the largest shareholder in every company on the planet. And so we need you to signal to your peers that you're more than just talk and that you want, if you want us to walk the talk, then you have to be a part of the leadership challenge too, which means that we have to have the courage to propose adopting these new governance structures like the Benefit Corporation. And you've got to have the courage to vote yes when we put those shareholder proposals out there. And so I think to your point about the constraints of the capital markets or what some people have called like the business case jail, is if everything has to be justified purely on short-term return on investment, the short-term return to capital, we're going to be in a very tight box. If we want to create a little bit more room for maneuver where those CEOs can seek to create value for all stakeholders, not just for shareholders, and they can take a long-term orientation, then we're going to need to change the rules of the game, and we're going to need to change the legal operating environment. And to do that won't only require CEO leadership, it will require investor leadership. And together, they can change the operating environment and change the incentives. And if we do that, then I think we can have lasting and meaningful behavior change.
You talk to people in this world all the time as part of the work you do. And I'm wondering whether they feel that there's a growing risk in not addressing this. When you look at public opinion research that breaks people out into age cohorts and people who are, you know, less than a decade away from retirement like me have a very different view of the economy and how it works and how it should work from so-called millennials who are now the largest age cohort in society. And they are telling opinion researchers, capitalism has failed me.
You got it. Less than 20% of those that age bracket identify as capitalists.
I'm 30 years old and I have to live with roommates. I'm just married and I don't know when I can have a kid. And on and on and on. And you just think, well, wow, if things keep going down this road that we're on, that kind of voter, that kind of citizen, that kind of pressed, in debt, unhappy person will be open to changing the rules of the game in a way that a lot of these CEOs are not going to be very happy with. Is there a sense that you can't risk killing the goose that lays everybody's golden eggs?
You're hearing from CEOs, both inside the U.S. and particularly outside the U.S., an increasing fear that if we don't address this problem, that problem is going to address us. It's going to come either way. We can either voluntarily and more aggressively move in this direction, or there will be political, social that turn into political solutions that will then drive a much more restrictive regulatory environment that we don't want. And so how do we move at least with the curve, if we're not going to be ahead of it, but at least be with the curve there. I think that the other piece of it is they're recognizing that those millennials that you talked about, which is now like the, not only the largest group, they're the largest segment of the workforce. And so back to the earlier point of the CEOs come to work every day and the number one objective is how do I attract and retain the best talent? Because every other problem I have is going to be solved by people. And so if I don't have the best people, then I'm not going to solve all the myriad and continuing problems that show up in the business challenges that I have. And so if those millennials are saying, I want to work with purpose, I want more than just a paycheck, I want to put my money where my values are, not only in my purchases, but in my investments. I've got to compete for talent. I've got to compete for customers. And increasingly, and this is the thing where it draws back to the BlackRock example, is that group of millennials is going to be the recipients of the largest wealth transfer in the history of humanity in the next two decades, right? Depending upon whose numbers you read, $20 to $40 trillion worth of wealth is going to pass from the current wealth, you know, holding generation, the boomers, into the hands of millennials. And if those same millennials that are making decisions about what coffee they buy or what apparel they buy are now holding the wealth, if I'm managing a big pot of money, I want to make sure that I don't lose my license to operate and that I don't have all those assets walking out the door to other fund managers who are going to be putting purpose at the center of their investment thesis. And so I think that you've got a fear not only of sort of a political reaction that could create a more regulatory, less traditionally business-friendly environment, but I think you've also got a different threat, which is customers walking away, workers walking away, and ultimately investment capital walking away. And as we move to a new majority nation in the next in the next 30 years, the folks that have been on the margins in the borderlands of our culture are no longer asking for permission to be at the table, but they're demanding an opportunity to shape the agenda. Again, getting back to the social contract, is ultimately the systems in the long run will reflect the expectations of society. And the expectations of society, it's no longer going to be acceptable to make a killing on your investments while the people that work for those companies don't make a living wage. That will be, people will look back on that in the history books as a moral blind spot in the same way that we look at redlining or lynchings or enslavement. If equity is about giving everyone what they need to succeed and more is about giving myself as much as I want, those are very different worldviews. And the worldview that feels ascendant is an equity-centered world, not a more-centered world.
Jay Cohen Gilbert, thanks for joining us.
Ray, thanks a lot for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jay Cohen Gilbert. He co-founded B-Lab. And Colin Mayer. He's the author of the book Prosperity, Better Business Makes the Greater Good. The program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez.
I think it's not just the amount of money you have at the end of the year. It's also, do you have dignity? Do you have meaning? Do you have purpose?
The fraying of the social fabric over the past 50 years has increased economic anxiety and stoked resentments in countries all around the world. Next on World Affairs, Gillian Tett of the Financial Times will join Jason Furman of the Kennedy School as part of our three-part series on rebuilding the social contract. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.